An Osho Talk. The Art of Dying. Talks on Hasidism.
The Art of Dying. Lecture number 10. 20th of October, 1976, at the Bhagwanshi Rajneesh Ashram, Pune.
The first question. You seem to be against demystification of life. In this reference, is it right to say that the movements in the West like Erika, Zen, Sufism, Est, TM, etc. are the inevitable synthesis between Eastern mysticism and Western science? The real synthesis will be a disappearance of East and West. It will not be a meeting. In the real synthesis, the East will not be there and the West will not be there. That's what I called yesterday the transcendental. East and West are polarities. If you try to synthesize between them, something of the East and something of the West, and make a hodgepodge out of it, it will be a compromise and not a synthesis. It will be mechanical, not organic. You can put things together. That is a mechanical unity. You cannot put a tree together. You cannot put a human being together. The unity of a tree grows. It comes from its own innermost core. It spreads towards its circumference. It arises in the center. A mechanical unity can be put from the outside. You can put together a car or a clock. The clock has no center in it. The car has no center in it. The clock has no soul. That is the meaning when we say the clock has no soul in it. It means it has no center of its own. It is a unity put together from the outside. It works. It is utilitarian. But a tree, a bird, a human baby, you cannot put them together. They grow. Their unity comes from their innermost core. They have a center. A compromise is a mechanical unity. A synthesis is an organic growth. So whatsoever is happening right now in the name of Est, TM, Erika is a sort of mechanical unity. And mechanical unity has its own dangers. The greatest danger is the East has developed a great insight into religion. The West has developed a great insight into science. When a Western person starts searching into the East, his attitude is scientific. He can understand only that which is scientific in the East. Try to understand this. And the East has not developed any scientific attitude. The Eastern science is very primitive and rudimentary. When a religious person goes to the West from the East, he looks into religion, into Western religion, which is very rudimentary, very primitive. He can understand only the religious language. So when somebody from the East approaches the West, he approaches the West from the weakness of the Western growth. And when somebody comes from the West to the East, he approaches the East from the weakest link in its growth. Now, what is happening? East and West meeting into Erica, Est, TM, and other so-called spiritual movements. Just the opposite is happening than that which was expected. It is not Eastern religion meeting Western science. It is Eastern science meeting Western religion. It is an ugly affair. You must have heard a French actress ask George Bernard Shaw that she would like to get married to him. Bernard Shaw inquired why. She said, the logic is simple. I have a tremendously beautiful body. Look at my face, look at my eyes, my form, it is perfect. And you have a beautiful intellect, the greatest intelligence ever. Our child will be a beauty, your brain and my body. George Bernard Shaw said, I am afraid things can go wrong. Our child may have my body and your intellect. This is what is happening. He declined to marry. He said it is dangerous. There is no certainty about it. And of course, George Bernard Shaw had a very ugly body. And actresses have been known to have any intellect. Intelligence is just a strange phenomenon to actresses. Otherwise, why in the first place they will be actresses? Est, Erica, TM are just byproducts of the marriage between George Bernard Shaw and the actress. Things have gone wrong. This is not a synthesis. This is a compromise, a hodgepodge, and very dangerous. A greater synthesis is needed. That synthesis will not come by movements. It will come only by a few people who attain to that synthesis in their souls. It is not a question that you read the Bible and you read the Bhagavad Gita and find out similarities and make a synthesis out of it. That will be a mechanical unity. Many people have done that. Dr. Bhagwan Das has written a very scholarly book, The Essential Unity of All Religions. The whole thing is silly. Read the Quran, read the Veda, read the Bible, read the Dhammapada, find out similarities. It is very easy to find out similarities. But in fact, the Quran is beautiful only where, only those things are beautiful which are not in the Gita. The beauty is in its uniqueness. When you find something as Mahatma Gandhi has done, he will read Quran and find out things which are similar in Gita. He is looking for Gita in the Quran. It is unjust to Quran. It is not good manners either. Because you are imposing some align element on Quran. And whatsoever is not similar to Gita, in tune with Gita, he will forget about it, that it exists in Quran. And that which is dropped was the uniqueness of Quran. The same can be done by a Christian. He can look into Gita and find out something which satisfies his Christian mind. Then he is looking for Bible in Gita. And Gita is beautiful only where it is not at all similar to Bible. It's uniqueness. Beauty is in uniqueness. Similarities become glitches. Similarities become meaningless. Similarities are monotonous. The Himalaya is beautiful because there is something unique that is not in the Alps. And the Ganges is beautiful because there is something that is not in Amazon. Of course, both are rivers. And there are 1,001 things similar. But if you go on looking for similarities, you will live in a very boring world. I'm not in favor of it. So I will not tell you to look into Eastern scriptures and into Western scriptures and find out some sort of compromise. No. I would like you to go to your innermost being. If you go beyond the object, you have gone beyond the West. If you go beyond the subject, you have gone beyond the East. And then arises the transcendental. And there is synthesis. And when it has happened within you, then you can spread it without also. The synthesis has to happen within human beings, not in books, not in dissertations, not in PhD theses. The organic unity is possible only in an organic way. This is what I am doing here. I am hammering you to go beyond the objective and beyond the subjective. I am not telling you to make subjective and objective meet inside you. Because meeting will not be able to bring the higher into existence. You have to go beyond. The future humanity has to go beyond the East and West. Both have been only half. Both have been lopsided. I am neither for East nor for West. I am for a total world, a world that is a whole. But it is natural in a way, Erika, S, TM, in a way natural. Because the common humanity, the ordinary human mind, always tries to find cheap methods, shortcuts, because people are really not interested in the ultimate truth. They are interested at the most in a convenient, comfortable life. They are not interested really in being alive and being an adventure. They are really afraid of all adventures. They want to put things together in such a way that things become comfortable. And one can live comfortably and one can die comfortably. Comfort seems to be the goal, not truth. And everybody has his own prejudice. The Christian, the Hindu, the Mohammedan. They all have their prejudices. They are very deep-rooted. You can talk about love, but that is always superficial. Let me tell you one anecdote. The distraught young man was perched on the 40th floor ledge of a midtown hotel and threatening to jump. The closer the police could get was the roof of an adjacent building a few feet below. However, all pleas to the man to return to the safety were of no avail. A priest from the nearest parish was summoned and he hastened to the scene. "Think, my son," he intoned to the would-be suicide in a very loving way, "think, my son, think of your mother and your father who love you." "Ah, they don't love me," the man replied. "I am jumping." "No, my son, stop," cried the priest with great love in his voice. "Think of the woman who loves you." "Nobody loves me. I am jumping," came the response. "But think, still think, my boy," the priest implored. "Think of Jesus and Mary and Joseph who love you." "Jesus, Mary and Joseph?" the man queried. "Who are they?" At which point the cleric yelled back, "Jump, you Jew bastard, jump." Now all love disappears immediately. All talk of love is just superficial. All talk of tolerance is very deep down intolerant. People say tolerate each other. What do you mean when you say tolerate each other? It is already intolerant. The very word tolerance is ugly. When you tolerate somebody, do you love him? When Hindus tolerate Mohammedans, do they love them? When Mohammedans tolerate Hindus, do they love them? Can tolerance ever become love? Tolerance may be politics, but it is not religion. One who wants to know the truth, truth that is beyond all polarities, man, woman, east, west, good, bad, heaven, hell, summer, winter. One who is interested in knowing, inquiring into the truth, which is beyond all dualities, has to drop all his prejudices. If he still carries his prejudice, that prejudice will color his mind. To know truth, you need not to be a Hindu, you need not to be a Mohammedan, you need not to be a Christian, you need not to be a Jew. To know truth, you have to drop all this rubbish. You have to be just yourself. You need not be Indian, you need not be American. You need not be English, you need not be Japanese, Chinese. To know truth, you have just to be immense, shoes, vital, alive, loving, inquiring, meditative, but with no prejudice, with no scripture, with no concept, with no philosophy. When you are completely nude with all that has been taught to you, all the conditionings dropped, then suddenly there is the highest truth. And that highest truth is a synthesis unto itself. You need not synthesize. It is an organic unity. And from that altitude, you can laugh at all the nonsense that goes on in the name of religion, in the name of tolerance, in the name of love, in the name of churches and temples and mosques. The revolution has to happen within you. It has not to be introduced in the world. Because only you are alive. The society is dead. The society is just a name. Only you have something of the soul. The synthesis has to happen there. The synthesis is not to happen in Pune or in New York or in Timbuktu or in Constantinople. The synthesis is happening, going to happen within you, within me. And each individual has to become a great experiment towards that synthesis. But remember, when that synthesis arises, you will not be able to say that it is a synthesis between East and West, between Mohammedan and Christian, between Hindu and Jaina. No. You will be immediately able to see it is a transcendence. Synthesis, real synthesis, organic synthesis, is a transcendence. Your altitude has changed. You are standing on a highest peak. From there you look. Whatsoever we look, whatsoever we see, is not much important. The most important thing is where you stand. If you are clinging to the East, whatsoever you see in the West will be a misinterpretation. Just the other day, I was reading in some newspaper, they had written an article against me. And the article says, how Americans can understand religion? How Western people can understand religion? So my whole effort is a wastage. Now this is the Indian chauvinist mind. The Indian thinks nobody can understand religion except the Indian. And this is not only so with the Indian. This is so with everybody. Everybody deep down carries this nonsense that we are the chosen few. This idea is very destructive. It is not a question of being American or Indian. Truth has nothing to do with all these labels. Truth is available to anybody who is ready to drop all these labels. Truth is understood only when you are neither American, nor Indian, nor Hindu, nor Christian. Truth is understood by a consciousness which is no more clouded by any conditionings, which is no more clouded by the past. Otherwise, we go on looking into things whatsoever we can understand. I was reading a very beautiful anecdote. The family managed to bring the patriarchal grandfather from Hungary, and he came to live with his daughter and her family. The old man was fascinated by New York and all it had to offer. One day, his grandson, Yankel, took him to the zoo in Central Park. Most of the animals were familiar to the old man, however. They came to the cage where the laughing hyena was confined, and the old man became curious. "Yankel, in the old country I never heard of an animal that laughed." Yankel noticed the keeper standing nearby and approached him. "My grandfather recently came from Europe. He says they don't have laughing hyenas there. Could you tell me something about him so that I can in turn tell him about it?" The keeper said, "Well, he eats once a day." Yankel turned to his father and said in Yiddish, "Jhaida, he eats once a day." The keeper continued, "He takes a bath once a week." "Jhaida, he baths once a week." The old man listened intently. The keeper added, "He mets once a year." "Jhaida, he mets once a year." The old man shook his head up and down and said thoughtfully, "All right, he eats once a day, he baths once a week, but if he mets only once a year, why is he laughing?" Now this old man is not so old. His mind is still clinging somewhere in his youthful days. His mind is still sexual. He cannot understand that if he mets only once a year, why is he laughing? There are people who cannot understand that happiness is possible in any other way than sex. There are people who cannot understand that there is any bliss beyond sex. There are people who cannot understand that there is any happiness except food. There are people who cannot understand that there is any happiness except big houses, big cars, much money, power and prestige. It is impossible to understand beyond your own standpoint. People remain confined in their own standpoints. That is the real prison. If you want a synthesis, you have to drop all the imprisonments. You have to drop out of your cages. They are very subtle cages, and you have decorated them for long. You may have even started loving them. You may have forgotten completely that it is a prison. You may have started thinking that this is your home. Hindu thinks Hinduism is his home. He never thinks that it is a barrier. All isms are barriers. The Christian thinks Christianity is the bridge. He never thinks that it is Christianity that is not allowing him to reach to Christ. The church is not the door. It is the wall, the barrier, the China wall. But if you have lived with this wall for too long, for centuries, if the mind has become accustomed to it, you think it as a protection, as a shelter, as security. And then you look at other people. From your cell in the prison, you look outside. Your presence in the cell corrupts your vision. Come out under the sky and under the stars. And synthesis will take care of itself. You need not synthesize East and West. You are simply to go beyond these standpoints. Move to the transcendental. And there is synthesis. The second question I have heard you saying, man is a goal-oriented process, and his destination is the stars. Can you please open this flower for me for a deep smell? The flower is open. I suspect your nose is closed. Your nose has to be opened. And you have to reclaim the capacity to smell. You may have lost the sensitivity to smell. You have lived so long in lies that when you come across truth, you cannot recognize it. Even truth has to come to you, if truth wants to be recognized, in the garb of a lie. You cannot directly see it. You have learned the ways how to look sideways. You never look direct, you never look immediate. You are always wavering this way or that. And you are always losing the fact. I am here. This is the flower I am talking about. I am your future. That which is going to happen to you has happened to me. If you cannot smell, then don't blame the flower. Then blow out your nose. But that is difficult for the ego. The ego is always ready to deny. It is never ready to transform itself. The ego can say, there is no God. It cannot say that it may be because I have got many blocks, I cannot feel God. The ego can deny there is no flower, but it cannot recognize the fact that I have lost the capacity to smell. Hence, there are so many people who deny God. It is easy to deny God. It is comfortable, in fact, because if there is no God, then you need not bother about your nose. Then you need not work upon your being. If there is no God, then there is no work. Then there is no growth. Then there is no search. You can go lazy. You can drown yourself in lethargy. If there is no God, then there is no guilt. I am against guilt. Guilt that has been created by the priests. But there is a different type of guilt which is not created by the priests. And that guilt is very meaningful. That guilt arises if you feel that there is something more in life and you are not working hard to get to it, then you feel a guilt. Then you feel that somehow you are creating barriers into your own growth. You are lazy, lethargic, unconscious, sleepy, that you don't have any integration, that you cannot move towards your destiny, then a guilt arises. When you feel that you have the possibility and you are not turning it into actuality, then a guilt arises. That guilt is totally different. I'm not talking about the guilt that priests have created in humanity. Don't eat this, otherwise you will feel guilty. Don't do that, otherwise you will feel guilty. Millions of things they have condemned. And if you eat, if you drink, if you do this and that, you are surrounded by guilty feelings. I'm not talking about that guilt. That guilt has to be dropped. In fact, that guilt helps you to remain where you are. These guilty feelings don't allow you to know the real guilt inside. They create so much fuss about small things. You have eaten in the night, then the gents create much fuss. You are guilty. You are a sinner. Why you have eaten in the night? Or you have divorced your wife or your husband, and the Catholics create a guilty feeling in you. Something wrong. It was not wrong to live with the woman and continuously fight. It was not wrong to destroy the woman and destroy yourself. It was not wrong to destroy the children. Just between two of you, they were being crushed. Their whole life was conditioned in a wrong way. No, it was not bad. But if you get out of your marriage, if you get out of that hell, you feel guilty. These guilty feelings don't allow you to see the real spiritual guilt, which has nothing to do with any politics, with any priesthood, with any religion and church. That guilt feeling is very natural. When you see that you can do something and you are not doing it. When you see how potential you are, but you are not changing that potentiality into actuality. When you see in seed, you are carrying such tremendous treasures, they can bloom. And you are not doing anything for it. And you are just remaining in misery. Then you feel a great responsibility towards yourself. And if you are not fulfilling that responsibility, you feel guilty. This guilt is of tremendous import. I am here, but the flower is here. In Zen they say that the flower does not talk. But I would like to contradict it. I would like to say to you, the flower talks too. Just one thing is needed. You need the capacity to hear. You need the capacity to smell. The flower has its own language. He may not talk in the language that you understand, but your language is a very local language. The flower speaks the universal language. I am here. Look into me. Feel me. Try to imbibe my spirit in you. Let my flame come closer to you. Any moment there can be the jump. My flame can jump and light your unlit candle. Just come close. Come close. And when I say come close, I mean be more and more in love. Love is the only closeness there is. Love is the only intimacy there is. It is not a question of physical closeness. It is a question of inner intimacy. Be open to me as I am open to you. Be available to me as I am available to you. Don't be afraid, you have nothing to lose. Accept your chains. The third question. Somewhere There is that fear which makes me closed and hard and sad and desperate and angry and hopeless. It seems to be so subtle that I don't even really get in touch with it. How can I see it more clearly? The only problem with sadness, desperateness, anger, hopelessness, anxiety, anguish, misery. The only problem is that you want to get rid of them. That's the only barrier. You will have to live them. You cannot just escape. Because they are the very situations in which life has to integrate and grow. They are the challenges of life. Accept them. They are blessings in disguise. If you want to escape from them, you somehow want to get rid of them, then the problem arises. Because if you want to get rid of something, you never look it directly. And then the thing starts hiding from you because you are condemnatory. Then the thing goes on moving deeper into the unconscious, hides in the darkest corner of your being where you cannot find it. It moves into the basement of your being and hides there. And of course, the deeper it goes, the more trouble it creates. Because then it starts functioning from your unknown corners of being and you are completely helpless. So the first thing is, never repress. The first thing is, whatsoever is the case, accept it and let it come. Let it come in front of you. In fact, just to say, do not repress is not enough. If you allow me to say, I would like to say, befriend it. You are feeling sad? Befriend it. Have compassion for it. Sadness also has a being. Allow it. Embrace it. Sit with it. Hold hands with it. Be friendly. Be in love with it. Sadness is beautiful. Nothing is wrong. Who told you that something is wrong in being sad? In fact, only sadness gives you depth. Laughter is shallow. Happiness is skin deep. Sadness goes to the very bones, to the marrow. Nothing goes so deep as sadness. So don't be worried. Remain with it. And sadness will take you to your innermost core. You can ride on it. And you will be able to know few new things about your being that you had never known before. Those things can be revealed only in a sad state. They can never be revealed in a happy state. Darkness is also good. And darkness is also divine. The day is not only God's, the night is also His. This attitude I call religious. Somewhere there is that fear which makes me closed and hard and sad and desperate and angry and hopeless. It seems to be so subtle that I don't even really get in touch with it. It becomes so subtle if you want to get rid of it. Of course, it protects itself. It hides into deepest corners of your being. It becomes so subtle and so garbed that you cannot recognize it. It starts coming in different, under different names. If you are so much against anger, then anger will come in a different name. It may become pride. It may become ego. It may become even a religious pride. It may become even pious. It may hide behind your virtues. It may start hiding behind your character. Then it becomes subtle, because now the label is changed. It is playing somebody else's role, but deep down it remains anger. Let things be as they are. And this is what religious courage is, to allow things as they are. I am not promising you any rose garden. Thorns are there. Roses also. But you can reach to roses only when you have passed the thorns. A man who has never been sad cannot be really happy. It is impossible for him to be happy. His happiness will be just a forced gesture, empty, impotent. You can see on people's faces when they laugh. Their laugh is so shallow. It is just painted on the lips. It has no relationship with their heart. It is absolutely unconnected. It is just like lipstick. The lips look red and rosy. But that rosiness, that redness does not come from the redness of the blood. Good if lips are red, but the redness should come from aliveness, from your blood cells, from your energy, vitality, youth. Now you paint your lips. They look red. It is ugly. Lipstick is ugly. And you will find only ugly women using it. What a beautiful woman has to do with lipstick? The whole thing seems to be absurd. If your lips are red, vital, alive, what is the point of painting them? You are making them ugly and false. Your happiness is also like lipstick. You are not happy. You know you are not happy. But you cannot accept the fact that you are not happy, because that will be too shattering for your ego. You and not happy, how can you accept it? Maybe you are not inside happy, but that is your own problem. You are not to express it. You are not to say the truth. For the world, you have to keep a face. You have to maintain a personality. So you go on laughing. Watch people's laughter, and you will immediately say which laughter comes from the heart. When the laughter comes from the heart, you can immediately feel a different vibe overflowing. The man is really happy. When laughter is just on the lips, it is empty. It is just a gesture. Nothing is behind it. It is a facade. The man who cannot laugh deeply is the man who has repressed sadness. He cannot go deep because he is afraid of sadness. Even if he goes deep in his laughter, there is a fear sadness may surface, may bubble up. He has to be always on guard. So please, whatsoever the situation, you start allowing it. If you are said, you are said. This is what God means for you. At this moment at least, He wants you to be said. So be truly said. Live this sadness. And if you can live this sadness, a different quality of happiness will arise in you, which is not a repression of sadness, which is beyond sadness. A person who can be patiently sad will suddenly find one morning a happiness is arising in his heart from some unknown source. That unknown source is God. You have earned it if you have been truly sad. If you have been truly hopeless, desperate, unhappy, miserable, if you have lived in hell, you have earned heaven. You have paid the cost. I was reading a joke. Mr. Goldberg came home from the office unexpectedly and found his wife in bed with Mr. Cohen, the next door neighbor. Distraught and angry, he ran next door and confronted Mr. Cohen. "Mr. Cohen," he cried, "your husband is in bed with my wife." "Calm down, calm down," Mr. Cohen said. "Look, don't take it so hard. Sit down, have a glass of tea. Relax." Mr. Goldberg sat quietly and drank his tea. It was then he noticed a little glint in Mr. Cohen's eye. "Quietly," she suggested, "you want a little revenge?" And with that, they withdrew to the coach and made love. Then they had another glass of tea, then a little more revenge. A little more tea, more revenge, more tea. Finally, Mr. Cohen looked at Mr. Goldberg and asked, "How about another revenge?" "I will tell you, Mr. Cohen," said Mr. Goldberg quietly, "to be truthful, I ain't got no hard feelings left." Whatsoever the situation, if you are sad, be sad. If you are in a revengeful mood, take the revenge. If you are jealous, be jealous. If you are angry, be angry. Never avoid the fact. You have to live it. That is part of life's progress, growth, evolution. Those who avoid remain immature. If you want to remain immature, then go on avoiding. But remember, you are avoiding life itself. Whatsoever you are avoiding is not the point. The very avoidance is avoidance of life. Confront life. Encounter life. Difficult moments will be there. But one day you will see those difficult moments gave you strength because you encountered them. They were meant to be. Those difficult moments are hard when you are passing through them, but later on you will see they have made you more integrated. Without them, you would have never been centered, grounded. The old religions all over the world have been repressive. The new religion of the future is going to be expressive. And I teach you that new religion. Let expression be one of the most fundamental rules of your life. Even if you have suffered for it, suffer. You will never be a loser. That suffering will make you more and more capable of enjoying life, of rejoicing in life. Fifth question. You are the best whiskey cook I have ever had. I stumble out of your lectures every day. My head is spinning. Should I give you up as a bad habit? It is very difficult to give up bad habits. Good habits, very easy to drop. Whoever has ever heard of any man or woman capable enough to give up a bad habit? And if religion has become your bad habit or sannyas, you are blessed. You are fortunate. If I am your bad habit, then you are fortunate. I will never like to become a good habit to you, no. Because a good habit can be dropped very easily. Let me tell you one anecdote. St. Peter, concerned about the state of affairs in America, sent his most dependable and conservative disciple, St. Teresa, to look over the situation and give him a personal report. She stopped first in New York and phoned at the end of 3 days to say things were even worse than they had feared. "Let me come home," she begged. "No," said St. Peter. "Finish the job. Go on to Chicago." She called him again from Chicago with an even more dismal tale. "It is a nest of corruption," she reported sadly. "Sinners on all sides. I can't take any more of it. Allow me to return to heaven." "Patience and fortitude," counseled St. Peter. "They tell me Hollywood is worst of all. Have a look around out there and then you can come home." 2 weeks went by. Then 4 weeks went by. Then 6 weeks went by. Without further word from St. Teresa, St. Peter, beside himself with anxiety, was about to turn the case over to the celestial FBI. When the phone finally rang, an operator said, "One moment, please. Hollywood calling." And then a sweet voice came over the wire. "Hello, Peter, darling. How divine. This is Terry. I would not like you to become Saint Teresa's. Even if you go to Hollywood, Hollywood is not going to corrupt you. I have corrupted you. Finally, utterly. I am a bad habit and never make out of me a good habit because good habits are not reliable. At the drop of the hat, good habits disappear. Let religion be your bad habit. Let meditation be your bad habit. Yes, it is perfectly good. Let me be your whiskey coke. The sixth question. When I first saw you, Bhagwan, I felt I found protection. Bhagwan will protect. But now, I am asking myself, how is Bhagwan going to protect me from Bhagwan himself? Please comment. That is not your problem. That is my problem. How I am going to protect you from myself, that is my problem, none of your business. One thing I can say, let me say it through an anecdote. Irving's life was over. His wife had left him and taken the children. He had lost his job. The bank had just foreclosed the mortgage on his house. He decided the only thing left for him to do was to jump off a bridge and kill himself. He walked to the Brooklyn Bridge and climbed as high as he could and was just about to jump when he heard a voice down below screeching, "Don't jump, I can help you." He yelled back, "Who are you?" To which the voice replied, "I am a bitch." Curious, he climbed down and there before him was an ugly old crone. She looked at him and said, "I am a witch, and if you do as I say, I will grant you 3 wishes." He thought to himself, "Things can't be any worse, so what do I have to lose?" So he said, "All right, what do I have to do?" She said, "Come home with me and spend the night." He went with her to her hovel, and she commanded him to make wild love to her. With great effort, he accomplished all her bidding, and finally fell asleep in a completely exhausted state. When he woke up, there was the ugly old woman standing in front of him. He said, "Now that I have done your bidding, old witch, you must keep your part of the bargain and grant me my 3 wishes." The hag looked at him and asked, "How old are you?" He replied, 42. The old woman sighed, "Do you mean to tell me that you still believe in witches? Listening to me so long, do you tell me you still believe in Bhagavan? My whole effort is to take all the props away from you, all beliefs, Bhagavan included. First, I pretend to give you help. Because that is the only language you will understand. Then by and by, I start withdrawing myself. First, I take you away from your other desires and help you to become very passionate about nirvana, liberation, truth. And when I see that now all desires have disappeared, there is only one desire, then I start hammering on that desire. And I say, drop it, because this is the only barrier. Nirvana is the last nightmare. You cannot go back, because those futile desires, once you have dropped them, you cannot get back into them. Once you have dropped them, the very charm, the very mystery disappears from them. You cannot really believe how you were carrying them for so long. The whole thing looks so ridiculous. You cannot go back. And I start taking the last desire from you. Once the last desire disappears, you are enlightened. Then you are Bhagavan. My whole effort is here to make you capable of declaring yourself that you are also God. And not only declaring, but living it too. The 7th question. When I think about your life on this earth and why you have come, it seems that there must be a risk in your undertaking and the possibility of failure, that your work cannot be granted, that you must also be able to err, to commit a mistake. It seems that if there is no freedom to err, then there is no freedom at all. But when I look at you, there is no question of mistakes. Egolessness is perfect. Please comment. First thing, I am not under any obligation to do anything. This is not an undertaking. I am not doing any work actually. It is not a work that I am doing. It may be work for you. It is not work for me. I am enjoying the game. It is a play. And in a play, it does not matter whether you make mistakes or not. It does not matter. Mistakes become very, very important when you are serious about a thing. When you are doing it as a serious work, then mistakes become very important. But I am not doing it seriously at all. It is a laughter. It is a dance. It is a play for me. I am enjoying it. And I have no plan, no blueprints for it. How can I commit a mistake? You can commit a mistake if you have a plan. Then you know where you missed. I carry no plans with me. I have no blueprint. I simply go on doing whatsoever happens in the moment. So whatsoever happens is perfectly right, because there is no way to judge it. There is no criterion. There is no touchstone. That's the beauty of it. And that's what freedom is. In a serious work, you can never be free. In a serious work, anxiety will always haunt you. In a serious work, you are always afraid something can go wrong. With me, nothing can go wrong, because there is nothing right either. If something is right, then something can go wrong. If nothing is right and nothing is wrong, that's what is the meaning of the Eastern concept of leela, play. It is a playfulness. Out of this playfulness, while I am here, I am enjoying it. I am terribly enjoying it, terrifically enjoying it. You ask, when I think about your life on this earth, you are thinking in wrong terms. You are thinking in terms that religions have conditioned your minds to think. You are thinking as Christians, Hindus, Mohammedans, Jainas. You have not yet learned my language. Christians think Christ came to deliver the whole world from sin. All nonsense. You can see the world is not delivered yet. In fact, if the world is completely delivered from sin, there will be no work left for Christ. He will go broke. He will go bankrupt. He will have to close the shop. Jainas think Tirthankaras come to help humanity. I can understand you want help, that I can understand, so you project help. But a Tirthankara is not to help you. He is simply enjoying. And if you want to enjoy, you can participate. He simply opens a door of spiritual enjoyment, of his spiritual bliss. And he is not worried whether you come or not. He is not worried whether few people come or millions come. If nobody comes, it is as good as when millions come. He is not in search of customers. He is happy. Things are going perfectly well for himself. If few people come and dance with him, good. If nobody comes, he dances alone. His dance remains perfect. It is not a work. Hindus think avatars come when the world is in misery, when the world is in ignorance, when religion disappears from the world, then avatars come. All nonsense. Because avatars have come so many times, the misery has not disappeared. The ignorance has not disappeared. Religion never becomes an established fact. In fact, the moment religion becomes established, it is no more religion. it becomes a church. Established religion is no more religion. Religion remains only unestablished. Religion is a rebellion. You cannot make anything established out of it. It is intrinsically rebellious. And the play continues. But I can understand why people have projected all over the world. This is their hope. They are in misery, that is certain. They want somebody to help them. Why you want somebody to help you? Because you don't want to take the responsibility on yourself. First you say, others have made me miserable. Now you say, somebody has to come to take me out of the misery. Then what you are doing? You can't create your misery, you can't drop it. So whether you exist or not, responsibility is existence. Responsibility gives you being. If you go on throwing your responsibility on somebody else, it is devil who is creating misery, and it is God who comes, becomes Christ, becomes Muhammad, becomes Mahavira, and takes you out of the misery. Then what you are doing? You seem to be just like a football. On one side devil, on one side God, and you are being kicked from this side to that. Enough. You simply say, enough. I'm not allowing to be kicked anymore. Are you a football? Claim responsibility. I'm not here to help you. You may be here to be helped, but I am not. I'm just enjoying my thing. I'm doing my thing. And you will be benefited more if you drop that idea of help and work and Christ and avatars. You will be helped more if you drop all concepts of help. You simply be with me. Don't bring business in it. Let it be a pure play. It seems that there must be a risk in your undertaking. There is nothing. No risk, because it is not an undertaking. I am not risking anything, because there is nothing to risk. There is nothing to lose. All that is always is. And that which is not never is. So what is the risk? If somebody comes and kills me, he kills only my body, which was already dead, has always been dead. It is part of the earth. So dust unto dust. He cannot kill me. I was before I was born. I will be before death, after death has happened. So what he has done? Nothing serious. Nothing of much importance. He may think he has done very serious thing, that he has killed, that he has crucified a Jesus or killed a Socrates. That is his idea. But in me, that which is matter is going to fall into matter, and that which is consciousness is going to disappear into consciousness. So nobody can kill me. You can shoot at me, but you cannot shoot me. You can cut my head, but your sword will not touch me. The sword is material and it cannot touch the spiritual. There is no risk and there is no possibility of failure, because there is no possibility of success either. I cannot succeed. So how I can fail? In fact, the very terminology of success, failure, benefit, loss is absurd, irrelevant. You ask that your work cannot be granted, that you must be able to err, to commit a mistake. It seems that if there is no freedom to err, then there is no freedom at all. The freedom is so absolute that there is no right and no wrong. The freedom is so absolute that whatsoever you do is right. Not that you have to do something and sometimes it is right and sometimes it is wrong. Try to understand my standpoint from my grounding, from my centering. Whatsoever you do is perfectly right. Not that it fulfills any criterion of right. Simply there is no criterion of right. That's why I can be with Hasids, I can be with Sufis, I can be with Tantrikas, I can be with Yogis. It is very difficult for so-called religious people. If they are with Mahavira, how they can be with Muhammad? Impossible. If one is right, then the other is wrong. If they are with Krishna, how they can be with Christ? If one is right, the other is wrong. Their mathematics is clear that only one can be right. To me, there is no criterion. You cannot judge who is right and who is wrong. Mahavira is right because he enjoyed his thing. Buddha is right because he also enjoyed his thing. Muhammad is right because he enjoyed tremendously his thing. Bliss is right. So whatsoever I am doing, I am enjoying it tremendously. And to be blissful is to be right. Even if I commit mistakes according to you, maybe sometimes you feel that this man is committing a mistake, that will be according to you because you carry some criterion. I stayed in a Jaina family once. An old man had come to see me, 90 years old. And he touched my feet and he said, "You are almost the 25th Tirthankara." I said, "Wait, don't be in a hurry. You just watch me." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You simply watch me. Otherwise you will have to take your words back." He became a little disturbed. It was just sun was setting and the evening was descending. And the woman, my host's wife, came and he said, "Your food is ready." I said, "Wait." The old man said, "What? The sun has already gone down the horizon. And are you going to take your food?" I said, "Yes. And I am telling to the woman that wait. I will have to take my bath and then I will take my food." He stood. He said, "Sorry. I must take my words back. You were right. You can eat in the night? You don't know even this much? Then what type of enlightened person you are?" Because he has a certain criterion. An enlightened person cannot eat in the night. The Jaina criterion. If you go to any person, he has criterions. He looks through those windows. If I fit right, if I don't fit wrong. But I am not here to fulfill your expectations. I am always right because I don't carry any criterion. There is no way. You cannot even find contradictions in me. Because whatsoever I said up to this moment is irrelevant. I don't bother a bit about it. Now it is for foolish scholars to bother. It is finished for me. The moment I say something, I enjoy saying it. That's all. More than that is not my concern. The moment I do something, I infinitely enjoy it. Beyond that, it is not my concern. But when I look at you, there is no question of mistakes. Egolessness is perfect. How egolessness can be perfect? The very idea of perfection is of the ego. Egolessness cannot be perfect. Egolessness simply means an absence of the ego. Can absence be imperfect? Absence cannot be imperfect, so how absence can be perfect? Absence is simply absence. Ego can be imperfect, ego can be perfect. Egolessness cannot be either. There is nobody to be perfect. Seeing the point that the whole game of ego is absurd, ego disappears. Nothing is left behind. There is a wholeness, but there is no perfection. There is totality, but there is no perfection. The old religions were all perfection-oriented. My whole teaching is whole-oriented. Be a whole. I don't say be perfect. And the difference is tremendous. When I say be whole, I allow you contradictions. Then be wholly contradictory. When I say be whole, I don't give you a goal, a criterion, an ideal. I don't want to create any anxiety in you. I simply want, in this moment, wherever, whatsoever you are doing and whatsoever you are, be totally in it. If you are sad, be totally sad. You are holy. If you are angry, be totally angry. Go into it totally. Now the ideal of perfection is absolutely different, diametrically opposite. Not only different, but opposite. The perfectionist will say, never be angry, always be compassionate. Never be sad, always be happy. He chooses one polarity against the other. In wholeness, we accept both the polarities, the lows and the highs, the ups and the downs. Wholeness is totalness. And you have to see the whole nonsense of the ego. Otherwise, ego can come from the back door. It can say, now become perfectly egoless. Now you have to prove that there is just nobody who is more egoless than you. Let me tell you one anecdote. A family with a son about to be bar mitzvah wanted to celebrate the occasion in a unique way. Money was no object. The caterer suggested many things, flying the party out to Disneyland, renting out the White House, having the affair in a nuclear submarine. All of these ideas were rejected by the family as old hat. It was not until the caterer came up with the idea of having the bar mitzvah on safari in Africa that the family grew excited. Invitations were issued to 200 guests. 200 plane tickets were bought and the group set off for Africa. In Africa, the bar mitzvah party was met by 200 elephants, 50 guides, 7 bugglers and 300 NATO porters who were to carry the food. Each guest mounted his own elephant with the father of the bar mitzvah boy in the rear of the procession. They were only several miles into the jungle when the whole caravan came to a sudden halt. From the rear elephant, the father cried, "What is going on there?" And the question was repeated 200 times till it reached the head guide at the front of the procession. The answer came back up the line, "We have to stop here for a little while." "Why?" wailed the distressed father, "Why?" wailed the 200 guests as the question proceeded up the line. And then came the answer, "There is another bar mitzvah party ahead." The whole ego trip is like that. You move in a circle. You can never be in the front. Never. Again, a bar mitzvah party ahead. Even in the darkest jungles of Africa, you cannot do anything that has not been done before. You cannot be anything that has not happened before. You cannot be unique. That's why ego can never be satisfied. Ego remains imperfect and goes on hankering for perfection. My whole message is to see the truth, to see the hell that ego creates in the name of perfection, uniqueness, and drop it. Let it drop. Then there is a tremendous beauty. No ego, no self. Just a deep emptiness. And out of deep emptiness is creativity. And out of that nothingness arises bliss, Satchidananda, truth, being, bliss, all arises out of that absolute purity. When the ego is not, you are a virgin. Christ is born out of a virgin. Your nothingness is that mother virgin, Mother Mary. The last question. And the most important one. In fact, a question of historic importance. Bhagwan, why do you always carry a towel? And why don't you drop it now? The first thing, the towel has been with me almost for 25 years. It is a silver jubilee year. And I am very surprised by the question, because only last night I had decided to drop it. I am reminded of a story. A man became very old. He became 100 years old. And the journalists came to interview him. And they asked many questions. And one journalist, hesitating a little whether to ask or not, so must have been the case with the person who has asked the question, must have hesitated for many times whether to ask such an absurd question or not. But he asked, the journalist asked, "Sir, one thing I want to know more. What do you think about women?" The old man said, "It's strange, because only this morning I decided not to think about women at all." 100-year-old man, this morning. And he said, "Please don't tempt me again. I had decided just the last night. But it is good that you have asked. It has a long history how it started to be with me. And before I depart company with it, it is better to tell the story to you. When I started living in Jabalpur, there were so many mosquitoes. And don't laugh, because you have nothing in Pune to be compared with Jabalpur. That's nothing. So the whole day I had to chase them with the towel. It was impossible to sit. Once a Buddhist monk, a very famous scholar, Bhikshu Jagdish Kashyap, stayed with me. He was my guest. When he saw the mosquitoes, he says, "I used to think that Sarnath is the top. But now it seems Jabalpur has defeated Sarnath." And he said, "I will tell you one story about Sarnath concerned with Buddha. Buddha came to Sarnath only once. His first sermon was delivered at Sarnath, but he never came again. So down the centuries, Buddhists have said he never came again because of the mosquitoes." I told Bhikshu Jagdish Kashyap, "Once I leave Jabalpur, I am not to go to come again. And I have not been there once I left." And I can understand Buddha's difficulty. How he should have managed without a towel? In his whole life, he visited the same towns many times. Sravasti at least 30 times. Rajgrah at least 40 times. And he never came back to Sarnath again. There must be some secret in it. In fact, mosquitoes are old enemies of meditators. Whenever you meditate, whether devil will come to tempt you or not, but mosquitoes will always come. For 18 years I was in Jabalpur. My towel became my constant companion. When I left Jabalpur and came to Bombay, I was thinking to leave it. But then people started spinning esoteric theories about it. Then just to save the theoreticians, I continued. Now it is a superstition. The word superstition comes from a root which means something which was useful sometime, but the circumstances has changed. It is no more useful, but it continues. This towel is a superstition. And I have continued it carrying just for your sake. Because there are theoreticians, esoteric people around who have something to base their theories upon. One woman, one of my beautiful sannyasins from Philippines, she told me that "I have found the truth about your towel." I asked what it is. She said, "You are a nobody. You live in nothingness. You have to hold something. Otherwise you will disappear." I said, "Right, absolutely right." Just three things I had: my lungi, my robe, and my towel. Lungi is gone, you can see. Parijat helped me to renounce it. Parijat is my official sea mistress, appointed by His Holiness Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh Ji Maharaj. She made the robe so beautiful that the lungi became almost absurd with it. It started looking like a bullock cart by the side of a Cadillac. So out of necessity, I had to drop it. Now here goes my towel. The only thing left is my robe. Please, never ask any question about it. Let me tell you one anecdote. A young Jewish couple
A young Jewish couple were being wed in the usual Jewish tradition, surrounded by at least 200 relatives and friends. The room was in complete hush as the rabbi reached the part of the service which said, "With all my worldly goods, I thee endow." The best man turned to the maid of honor and said, "There goes Irving's bicycle. And here goes Bhagwan's towel. That is all that I have. So I must remind you again, never ask any question about my robe." "I will throw the towel, whomsoever it lands on, becomes its proud owners. But nobody has to raise hands or to try to catch it." You simply be just in a meditation. Absolutely passive. That's the way God also descends. If you try to catch, then you cannot be the owner of it. If you try to catch, then you cannot be the owner of it. And if there is some problem and some dispute arises, the two or three persons claim, you can always go to Mullah Nasruddin. It will be difficult to locate him because he is a very subtle and invisible man. But he is the best. If you cannot locate him, then you can go to the next best, Swami Yog Chinmay. He will decide the dispute, who is the owner. And if it cannot be decided, then you can always divide it. Remember that you are not to catch it. If you try to catch, you miss the opportunity. Let it land on you. Here goes Bhagwan's towel. Enough for today.